This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli soldiers fired tear gas towards a Lebanese lawmaker and group of journalists near the occupied Sheba Farms amid tensions in the region. Hundreds of flights were grounded in Europe as airport and airline staff in Italy and Belgium go on strike demanding higher pay and better working conditions. And mass killings are accelerating in the U.S. as figures show country witnessed the deadliest 6 months of mass killings this year since 2006. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the Israeli army has fired tear gas towards a Lebanese member of parliament who was touring an area near the Israeli-occupied Sheba Farms. Lebanese lawmaker Qasem Hashem was accompanied by a group of journalists. Several people, including Hashem himself, have reportedly been injured. Israeli forces demand the journalists leave the area despite the fact they're in Lebanon's territory. Area near the Lebanese southern border has recently witnessed tensions after Israeli occupation forces erected a barbed wire fence there and constructed a concrete wall around the entire occupied village of Al-Gajar. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Sfella, says Israel's capturing more areas in southern Lebanon amid inaction from the international organizations.
Now, what we are looking at is something that is considered by Hezbollah, and they have been monitoring it, and it has been also explained elaborately. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah very recently, he spoke about how Hezbollah have been monitoring the situation, and the Israelis have been basically taking in, bit by bit, more Lebanese land, especially in the area of the village of Ghajar. Now, the Ghajar village's situation is a bit different from what we have in the Sheba Farms. At the Sheba Farms, we have some complications there since in the United Nations, it is not clear whether it's Syrian or Lebanese. The Lebanese say it is a Lebanese territory. Even Syrian officials have told Lebanon, but we are yet to demarcate that area and to make it official. But the Ghajar village is officially Lebanese. We have Lebanese documents. We have people who own that property, and they clearly say it is Lebanese. It has been since the demarcation between Lebanon and Palestine. Now, that is where the problem lies, since the Israelis are very openly taking more land from that village. So what Hezbollah decided to do, since they have called on the Lebanese government on and on for the past year, to take things into their own hands, to follow things up diplomatically. And when things were not solved as such, or the international players, the United States, they did not really heed to the call of the Lebanese government.
Strikes by airport and airline staff have grounded hundreds of flights in Italy and Belgium, causing large-scale travel disruptions. In Italy, some 1,000 flights, including domestic and international, have been canceled as a result of the walkout. Strike action has left so far at least 250,000 travelers stranded. Italian airline staff are calling for higher pay and better working conditions. Similar strikes are underway in Belgium, where more than 100 flights are to be impacted by the walkout. Belgian trade unions have warned as many as 80% of pilots could walk out during the action. Our correspondent in Rome, Max Civilli, tells us more about strikes by airport airline staff in Italy and subsequent travel chaos.
About 1,000 flights, according to the civil aviation, it's more than that, have been canceled today. About 250,000 travelers were left stranded across the Italian peninsula. It's a long-planned strike that the government led by Giorgia Meloni has tried to avert. The unions demand a new collective contract 6 years after the previous one expired. Basically, the cost of living has gone up exponentially over the past months. Since the energy crisis back in 2021 started and then aggravated in 2022 with the start of the war and the sanctions imposed on Russia, which basically forced the European Union to, and Italy of course, to get its supply of gas from other countries. The cost of energy has gone up dramatically, I would say up by 40-50%, and this of course has had a direct repercussion on the cost of living, food and all basic items has gone up by 30-40%.
Turkey on Monday agreed to allow Sweden to join NATO. And now a new report says Ankara gave the green light only after Washington promised Turkey an International Monetary Fund credit line. That's according to an article by American award-winning journalist Seymour Hersh. He says that U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to provide Turkey with an IMF aid worth up to $13 billion. He cited sources who had direct knowledge of the transaction. Ankara had previously conditioned its approval on dropping for Sweden to drop its support for Kurdish militant groups that Ankara considers terrorist outfits. Russia has warned that NATO expansion raises the risk of the Ukraine conflict escalating. It's warned Russia will be forced to take countermeasures. New figures show U.S. gun violence is sharply on the rise, with number of people falling victim to mass killings throughout the country. During our news review program, we took a closer look at the reasons behind this deadly phenomenon.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Newly released figures show the first half of 2023 saw the highest number of mass killings in the U.S. since at least the year 2006. Figures obtained by the Associated Press and the USA Today say 28 mass killings were reported in the U.S. from January till the end of June. Nearly 150 died and more than 70 were injured. Mass killing is defined as an occurrence when four or more people are slain within a 24-hour period. The database maintained by the Associated Press and USA Today tracks this large-scale violence dating back to 2006. The 2023 milestone beat the previous record of 27 mass killings, which was only set in the second half of 2022. Mass shootings are common in the U.S., where politicians remain deadlocked over tighter gun control laws. Colin Campbell, a correspondent, joins us from Washington, D.C. We also have Shabir Rizvi, who's a political commentator, joining us from Chicago. Welcome to you both. Colin Campbell, does this piece of news even get highlighted in the U.S. in terms of how we are covering it?
Not so much, actually, because gun violence is so common here in the U.S. We see the headlines day to day that there's been a shooting here, a shooting in another city. But as far as legislation and what can be done to curb gun violence, that's really not hitting the front pages like it normally does or like it normally would. However, we do realize in the U.S. because of various shootings, especially when they're holidays or when they're late news cycle, that there are lots of shootings that are happening around us. So we are very aware that they're happening. We are aware that there are people dying. There are constant polls that have come out showing how dangerous gun violence is in the country. But as far as media coverage and mainstream coverage, pressuring politicians or acting in an activist way to put some encouragement to politicians to try to change policy, that's really not happening in a way that a lot of Americans would like to see.
Well, taking a look at where you're at, Shabir Rizvi, in Chicago, I think Chicago is a place that has a high rate of, unfortunately, a high rate of murders that take place, which obviously is a consequence of gun violence. Tell us what you think, especially with this report that has come out, that it's experiencing a highest rate overall since the year 2006.
Absolutely. I mean, I think with anything, with most things, you have to look at the money. The United States is a unique situation where, you know, the gun lobby has a lot of power, has a lot of money, and has the ability to influence Congress to essentially make sure that people in Congress who are in charge of legislation don't do anything to make sure that, you know, there's gun safety or there's gun laws. In fact, I think on record with the amount of killings they're doing, there's also a record amount of gun legislation happening, and sorry, gun lobbying happening, where, you know, the NRA, for example, the National Rifle Association, is giving a record amount of money to people in Congress to make sure that, you know, Congress looks the other way. On the flip side of that, also with, you know, just following the money and the spirit of that, violence is a result of socioeconomic conditions. So you're also seeing a high rise in poverty amongst Americans. And when Americans are, not just Americans, but when anyone is forced into poverty, when there's, like, you know, crippling socioeconomic conditions, it's very common to resort to violence. If the American experience, you know, with the ease and the access to guns, with more wealth and inequity and inequality, you can definitely expect more violence. And I think until you get money out of Congress and put it into, you know, communities that actually need money, you are going to continue seeing gun violence.
Thank you so much there, Shelby Risley, political commentator from Chicago. And Colin Campbell, thank you, correspondent who spoke to us from Washington, D.C. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
The Southeast Asian bloc ASEAN has held a security meeting in which top diplomats from the United States, China, and Russia were present. Some of the issues discussed were the disputed South China Sea, the Ukraine war, and North Korea's missiles, but issue of most concern, stability of the region.
The 27-member ASEAN Regional Forum meeting in Indonesia. In attendance, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, China's top diplomat Wang Yi, and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Officials from Japan, South Korea, the U.K., and Australia were also present. Blinken and Lavrov's presence at the meeting was filled with tensions, but no bilateral talks would take place. Issues like Myanmar were still of major importance to the bloc.
Kita juga menerima dukungan yang kuat dari pertemuan bilateral dan trilateral terhadap peluasan fokus ARF dari CBM juga menjadi preventif diplomasi.
The Indonesian foreign minister did not waste any time addressing what was on her mind. She likened geopolitical tensions in the Indo-Pacific as a Cold War in hot places, in reference to U.S. provocations against China. The ASEAN chair, Indonesian President Widodo, said the gathering aimed to seek solutions rather than exacerbate regional and global problems. Yet the U.S. Secretary of State failed to see the concern of ASEAN when it came to the U.S. provocations against China. The former Chinese ambassador to the U.S. believes that the United States only pays lip service to ASEAN centrality.
ASEAN centrality is one of the most important principles in regional cooperation in Asia Pacific. And ASEAN countries attach great importance to that. We in China also attach great importance to that. Frankly, I think the United States very often just pay lip service to this principle. They also talk about, well, they like this idea.
Indeed.
But watch what they are doing. There's no ASEAN in Quad. There's no ASEAN in AUKUS. So where is the central role of ASEAN?
The ASEAN centrality emphasizes the association's dominant regional role to overcome common challenges and to engage with external powers. The U.S. has been criticized for building mechanisms and initiatives in the Asia-Pacific region, bypassing the ASEAN, even though it says it respects the ASEAN centrality.
Taking center stage at the ASEAN security meeting this year, highly contentious issues like the South China Sea, Ukraine war, and North Korea's missiles. Taking a closer look at these issues, which threaten the unity of the bloc, there's one common factor which is the source of the problem, and that is the U.S.
There are no illusions on the part of ASEAN. The U.S. is after China, and that can lead to a military confrontation. They realize that the threat is very real, and so are ASEAN countries' concern. So real that the Indonesian president has said that ASEAN cannot become a proxy for other countries. China, in contrast to the U.S., has been a reliable trading partner for the ASEAN region as a whole. The fruitful economic and trade cooperation between them have brought hope to the region and the world, according to the Chinese ambassador to ASEAN.
在世界经济持续低迷、各大机构总体调低全球经济增长预期的大背景下，中国动贸贸易展现出了强劲韧性和发展动能，给地区乃至世界经济带来了希望，有力促进了区域经济一体化和全球产业链供应链的稳定畅通。
But the U.S. believes that China is responsible for the crisis in South and East China Sea, including the Taiwan Strait, whereas the U.S. has been responsible for that. ASEAN countries were mere spectators when it came to another hot-button issue, and that was the Ukraine war. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's anger and animosity towards Russia was on full display.
It's fair to say that based on what we heard from Foreign Minister Lavrov today, his interventions and engagements were not constructive or productive on any issue.
And on North Korea, the U.S. had increased tensions since it had only flexed its military muscle with its allies.
Common security. And there is no greater challenge to that common security than the ongoing provocations coming from North Korea, from the DPRK, yet another missile launch just a couple of days ago.
The U.S. Secretary of State has said that the region must be free to choose partners, to make their own choices. Maybe it's time for these countries in ASEAN to rethink their relationship with the U.S., which has been the source of instability, before it is too late.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Iranian President Dr. Seyed Ebrahim Raisi has begun a three-nation visit to sub-Saharan Africa recently for the first trip in 11 years by an Iranian president aimed at increasing Iran's footprints in a region with an economy of $600 billion. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Press TV noted, Iranians and Africans have traded since times immemorial, the testimony of which is the many inhabitants of the Swahili coast and the nearby Indian Ocean islands of Zanzibar, Pemba, and Comoros, generally known as the Shirazi people. Modern Swahili people have an oral history embracing both African and Asian roots, including one text which traces the founding of Tanzania's Kilwa, to the arrival of a Persian prince. The self-governing island of Zanzibar in Tanzania, apart from bearing a Persian name, has preserved numerous traces of its historical links with Iran. Many of its residents, based on oral tradition, are descendants of Iranian merchants from Shiraz, who directly settled various mainland ports and islands on the Eastern Africa seaboard beginning in the 10th century in an area between Mogadishu, Somalia in the north and Sofala in the south. A study of centuries-old DNA published in the prestigious journal Nature in March estimated that people of African and Persian ancestry began to have children together in the Swahili coast region around the year 1000 AD. Iran, after 1979 Islamic Revolution, embarked on renewing relations with the African people based on Islam's prohibition of racism. The current leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, paid 6 state visits to Africa during his 2 4-year terms as Iran's president, when the country was in a war imposed by the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. The policy of strengthening relations with Africa continued during the terms of the next Iranian presidents, who paid 41 visits to Africa in total. Trade between Iran and Africa increased between 2005 and 2006, but the global financial crisis and cruel sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic under a UN Security Council resolution in 2007 decimated it. Surveys show Iran's trade with Africa has remained subdued at about $1.2 billion over the past few years, during which no significant step was taken to restore economic relations. That is going to change, according to the Director General of the Africa Office of Iran Trade Development Organization, who expects Tehran's trade with Africa to hit $10 billion in the next 3 years. Africa is home to 18% of the world's population, with an increasing population growth. It is a vital region with some of the fastest-growing economies in the world, where countries are now more stable and predictable places to live, work, and build businesses. Africa is rich in natural resources ranging from arable land, water, oil, natural gas, minerals, forests, and wildlife. It is home to some 30% of the world's mineral reserves, including 40% of the world's gold and up to 90% of its chromium and platinum. The largest reserves of cobalt, diamonds, platinum, and uranium in the world are in Africa, which also holds 65% of the world's arable land and 10% of the planet's internal renewable freshwater source. According to Mehrad Ebad, a member of Tehran Chamber of Commerce, Africa's foreign trade has grown significantly in the last 20 years, but Iran has not been able yet to use the capacity. He told Mizan News Agency, that said, the African market still remains virgin territory and Iran can stake out a share of this market. In Ebad's words, the lack of proper representation of the African market to Iranian businessmen and economic entrepreneurs is one of the reasons why Iran is lagging behind other countries in the continent. Another reason is the cruel sanctions. For exports to Africa, Iranian traders have to send their goods through neighboring countries such as the UAE, Oman, and Turkey, which entails in re-exports and higher export costs. To increase trade and relationship with African countries, Iran should activate joint chambers of commerce in order to introduce target markets and existing risks, because Iranian exporters generally have little knowledge about the continent. Africa is a safe and low-risk destination for Iranian traders, with a market for minerals, oil and gas, nano and food products such as pistachio and saffron, as well as polymers, petrochemicals, and technical engineering services. Meanwhile, there is ample capacity in Iran for shipment of goods to African countries by sea, which is the most affordable way to move products all around the world and suited to many business types. One of the remarkable upsides of Iranian trade with African countries is the distance factor. The distance between Iran and Africa is much shorter than between, let's say, China and Africa. This is a significant advantage which Iran can use to increase trade with the African continent. President Raisi's visit to Africa is on track to enhance Iran's economic and political relations and pave the way for development of trade exchanges that will benefit the private sector most. Exporters and owners of private businesses have tagged along with President Raisi's delegations in his recent foreign visits. According to Abad, one of the solutions is to increase and embolden the private sector's role in foreign trade and the accompaniment of private enterprises in the president's foreign visits will benefit Iran's economy at the end of the day. African markets are diverse, and buying power is growing among consumers across the continent. Iranian economists say the country can carve out a niche with proper planning, emphasizing the role of the private sector and developing joint chambers of commerce. Iran's trade with different African countries is varied. It has had good economic success with the eastern countries of the continent, such as Kenya and Tanzania, but not as much in many others. It is time to unleash capacities at full throttle, increasing exports, offering technical and engineering services, and investing in some projects which would mutually benefit both parties and build new bridges between their nations.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and here is a wonderful formula for salvation, as bequeathed to us by the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. My intercession with God on the Day of Judgment for my Ummah will be only for those who loved my Ahlul Bayt.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, patience with our spouses. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear friends, it is such an honor to be here at your service. In today's episode, we are going to be talking about patience with our spouses. Now, for some of us who have not been married at this point in time in our lives, it is still important to start to learn certain lessons when it comes to Islamic lifestyle that deal with married life. Of course, we know how it is incredibly encouraged, and it is highly encouraged and recommended by the teachings of the Holy Quran and the teachings of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, as well as the infallible imams, the importance of getting married, and that too, the importance of getting married at a young age. Now, here with this encouragement to get married, of course, we have to know the different various aspects when it comes to getting married. Of course, one of these things, as we all know, is to have patience with our spouses. Many a time, you know, we have a tendency to be patient outside the house, but when it comes to being patient inside the house, some of us, if not many of us, tend to falter in this area. And so it's incredibly important for us to be able to have patience when it comes to inside our homes. And of course, probably the primary individual and the primary relationship that we have inside our homes is that of our spouses. Welcome back, dear friends. This is A to Z on IRIB. So we are talking about, dear friends, how one should be patient with their spouses. Now, we had said how, of course, and it makes sense and it is natural, that the primary individual and the primary relationship in our houses, once we get married, is that we have with our spouse. And now our spouse, whether it is our husband or it is our wife, this is a lifelong relationship. And so we need to put a lot of effort into this kind of a relationship. Now, of course, people are different. People have different points of views. People have different ways of thinking. People have different ways of going about and doing things. And so we are going to have to be patient with one another if we want to have a healthy and successful marriage and an Islamic marriage in our Islamic lifestyle. And this is highly rewarded as well by the Almighty Allah when an individual embarks upon marriage and when an individual wants to live their life in a married life in this Islamic lifestyle, then of course we find that there are certain requirements. And one of those requirements, of course, is patience. And if you have patience with your spouse, then most surely your marriage will be healthy and you will be living a Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Part 1.
Karl Lagerfeld passed away on February 19, 2019. He was one of the most famous fashion designers in the world, and the news of his death became the headlines of European newspapers and news agencies all around the world. Of course, the news of the death of this German fashion designer who lived most of his life in France was not the only important issue of those days. Reporters and journalists soon reported that Karl Lagerfeld had made a strange will. Having no heirs, he left a great amount of his fortune to his pet, a cat called Choupette. A little later, the French news agency estimated that this considerable wealth is more than 3 million euros and will be used for the greater welfare of Choupette. Now Choupette has two mates, a bodyguard, and several popular pages on social media. It seems that Choupette has been able to make the animated theme of the Aristocats a reality. Although she's known as the richest and most famous cat in the world, it must be said that she is not the only animal that has managed to attract attention. Other species of animals have managed to be in the center of human attention in recent years, although not as much as Choupette. Numerous reports that are published from various competitions and events related to animals from all over the world prove that having pets is not specific to a particular geography, but an important and comprehensive issue in developed countries. This news is sometimes about a pet grooming salon in Taiwan that has many customers. Sometimes it is dedicated to the news coverage of the annual selection of the world's ugliest dog. A popular competition with a prize of $1,500 is held annually in Petaluma, California, among recently rescued street dogs. Of course, these events are sometimes so strange that the reader of these news is astonished. There are events like the annual dog surfing competition in California's Del Mar Beach, an architectural exhibition for pet dogs in London, and of course a priest's blessing of pets in Lima, Peru, and hundreds of other annual events in every corner of the world. The large number of these types of competitions and strange events, which have become the topic of discussion among animal advocates in recent years, may raise the important question of when humans became interested in raising and keeping animals. Archaeological findings and the oldest murals left by mankind prove that more than 15,000 years have passed since the domestication of animals by humans. It seems that the first cases of domestication of animals were with the aim of using them for a better life. Dogs were domesticated to protect humans from predators, cats to hunt vermin and guard granaries, cows and sheep to produce dairy, horses to transport goods and passengers, and pigeons to send letters. Of course, this type of domestication, which was sometimes accompanied by violence, was more common among the normal people than among the nobles and the rich. The only social class that raised and kept animals for fun in those days were the gentiles and the rich. This process took a serious form with the arrival of the 17th and 18th centuries in Europe. Signs of domesticated animals that were raised for fun and pastime can be found in a large number of paintings from the past centuries. Paintings that were commissioned by the rich and powerful ones to reflect their way of life. In the beginning of the 20th century and the industrialization of life, the use of animals in daily life underwent extensive changes. On the one hand, with the progress of science, scientists were able to create genetic changes in some animals, such as dogs, and use them for special purposes. And on the other hand, increasing the welfare level of more people had made keeping pets a hobby. Now, the lifestyle of the aristocrats and rich people of the past centuries had spread to the life of the newly emerging middle class in Europe and the US. Having a pet had become a normal subject in their lives. By the second half of the 20th century, having a pet turned into an epidemic. It was rare to find a family in the United States of America that did not want to keep pets. With the beginning of the 21st century, owning a pet reached a high history. According to the research of Walpole Institute, in the United States, every American child asks his parents for a pet 11 times a month. For years, some anthropologists and, of course, a large number of animal rights advocates have tried to analyze the reasons for the growing interest of humans in having pets in the modern lifestyle. Some of these people have said that the vulnerability and pitiful nature of some animals have attracted human attention, and others believe that keeping pets can be reminiscent of keeping children. We shall consider the fact that the responsibility of raising a child is much more than keeping a pet. According to the report of the American Pet Products Association, more than 93% of dog and cat owners in the United States stated that emotional connection, spiritual attachment, and of course entertainment are the most important reasons for keeping pets. An interest that may have been intensified by the childlike appearance of bulldogs or pugs or other animals such as cats or rabbits. Of course, paying too much attention to some species and keeping them by humans has become more extreme in recent years. The large number of websites that offer pet-related products shows that class differences and luxury have arisen not only among humans, but also among animals. There are strange products such as vitamin supplementation and herbal medicines to reduce anxiety, smart toys, sleep aids, shampoos, waxes, hot tubs, perfume, and a variety of clothing for special occasions. Of course, course, the extent of this extreme attention to animals liked by humans is not limited to these internet websites. The exhibition that is held annually in a large number of countries to supply this type of products is another wonder of this field. Now they call all of it the pet industry. One of the most famous of these exhibitions is the annual event of Disneyland in Florida, United States of America. It is a famous exhibition in an area equal to 13 football pitches and with the presence of more than 5,000 companies producing products related to pets. In the numerous booths of this exhibition, strange, diverse, and expensive products are offered, including cosmetics, jewelry, furniture, sunglasses, diapers, and psychotherapeutic drugs for pets. So visitors choose these products according to their taste. Considering the presence of pets in the homes of 63% of Americans, their great interest in this exhibition is not so strange. Their interest in products related to pets has increased the value of the pet industry in the United States to $40 billion a year. This is a significant number that has doubled compared to 1994. However, the variety of these flashy, showy, and unnecessary products raises serious questions about animal welfare concerns. But the owners of this industry have a different opinion about this issue. They consider it necessary to buy and use these goods, and citing researches that have not yet been verified, they emphasize that keeping animals not only reduces stress and improves the lives of humans, but also helps to improve the conditions of the animals themselves. A questionable opinion that has been proven to be incorrect according to some evidence. Another aspect of keeping pets, according to some researchers, is that some animal species cannot attract humans' attention due to purely external reasons. More precisely, human attention to some animals and lack of attention to others has caused the life of less popular animals to be in danger.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Recently, U.S. President Joe Biden has advertised his economic policies despite poor poll numbers, indicating that the American people have very little confidence in his ability to steer America's economy. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of Fox Business has covered this story and tells us more, revealing just how costly Joe Biden administration policies are for the average American household. A top economist and budget watchdog warned of an economic crisis not seen in years. Casey Mulligan, from University of Chicago, professor and former chief economist at the White House Council of Economic Advisers, said on Fox and Friends recently, "This is an active, across-the-board human capital crisis like we haven't seen for decades." Casey Mulligan added, "And that's hurting our economy, and it regularly hurts people in their everyday lives." In a recent report authored by Casey Mulligan that compares fiscal impact between the Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and Biden administrations, data showed U.S. households are facing $10,000 worth of extra costs, mostly from automobile fuel economy and emission standards. When evaluating what added costs Americans would have faced under a second conservative Trump administration, the average U.S. household was estimated to save $21,000 over 8 years. Casey Mulligan explained, "Workers are not able to be as productive as they used to be. We see it at the school level. The kids aren't learning. Wages aren't keeping up with inflation. That's the other side of the productivity coin." Casey Mulligan added, "And then a lot of people are dying, and not from COVID, but from more than normal deaths, from traffic accidents, diabetes, heart attacks, and so on. The list just goes on and on." According to the report, if President Biden's regulatory costs continue to rise at their current rate, American households can expect to lose $60,000 if the president wins re-election. Casey Mulligan said other executive orders and agency rulemaking outside of energy policy plays into the potential extra costs. The economist said healthcare business, telecommunications business, these are things adding to our internet bills, adding to our banking fees and prescription drug costs, etc. He said, "So when you add all the thousands of regulations together, adding you aren't getting something that is very noticeable and impactful for everyday people." The report also notes how President Biden's resurgence of regulatory burdens may become exacerbated by stagnant economic growth at home. Low productivity and inflationary pressures remain a problem. Casey Mulligan added, "President Trump did something, first thing that he had ever happened in American history. He had a budget for the regulators." Mulligan added, "And he comes from business. No businessman runs his business without a budget for his managers." He claimed, "And so he gave all his regulators a budget that we saw some results from that. They were cutting out old regulations, cutting out undescended regulations, and they were putting in some new ones, and they felt were needed." The website of Democratic Accent has also covered the same story and tells us more. Recently, President Biden touted his Bidenomics policies despite poor poll numbers indicating that the American public have very little confidence in his ability to steer America's economy. According to a new report, the Biden administration's burdensome regulations have cost the American public about $10,000 per household, which noted that figure could skyrocket if President Joe Biden is re-elected in 2024 and serves another 4 years. According to the report, as of the end of last year, the Biden administration imposed new regulatory costs on American households and businesses at a pace that is surpassing that of the Obama administration during a comparable time period. Specifically, economists say that the Biden administration has so far been adding regulatory costs at a rate of $617 billion per year of rulemaking, not counting regulatory costs created by statuses and other non-rule regulatory actions. They calculate that the added costs of these Biden-era rules finalized in 2021 and 2022, including both their current and expected future costs, amount to about $9,600 per American household. These costs are spread over time rather than concentrated in the first year that the rules take effect, and could spike significantly if Joe Biden is re-elected. If rulemaking and regulatory costs continue to accelerate at the same rate as they did during the Obama administration, the report states, the result after 8 years under Biden would be a cumulative $7 trillion deficit, which is almost $60,000 per household. According to the report, still, President Biden has fewer regulations per year than Barack Obama and Donald Trump in almost every category. However, U.S. officials claim the current administration has implemented some especially costly regulations, such as action on student loans and vaccine mandates.
Britain has been rocked by scandal upon scandal from its police force. The organisation has repeatedly been found wanting when it comes to stamping out corrupt and criminal behaviour in its ranks. My name is Michael Doherty. I'm a civil liberties campaigner and founder of Justice Now. I seek to bring about fundamental change to the systems of police accountability in the UK. Daniel Morgan was murdered in cold blood in 1987. And nearly three decades on, his killer has still not been brought to justice. His family have fought tirelessly to keep the case alive.
At every stage, you know, the criminal justice system has let us down, you know.
Allegations of police corruption and cover-up began just weeks after Daniel's death, yet five separate investigations have failed to get to the truth.
Our balances and checks in our society, in our oversight of police, for example, should, in theory, spring into action and take up the case on their behalf. But that hasn't happened in this case.
The Metropolitan Police may have turned over a new leaf, but is it too late to catch the killers of Daniel Morgan?
It remains one of the really scandalously unsolved crimes of the last 20 years or so.
On the 10th of March, 1987, a private investigator by the name of Daniel Morgan left this South London pub, heading to the car park. But he never reached his car. He was attacked from behind, killed in a savage attack by a man wielding an axe. Daniel's brother, Alistair, describes the assault.
The first blow was kind of to the crown of his head, you know?
And this is with an axe?
Yeah, with an axe, yeah. In fact, he was struck four times with the axe. And then while he was on the ground, the final blow just was straight into his... And it severed the brain stem. It was so violent. The axe was embedded to the haft in his head, you know.
Examinations revealed Daniel's watch had been stolen from his wrist and his trouser pocket ripped. Signs of a robbery, perhaps. But his killer had left a wallet full of cash in his jacket pocket. The whole murder seemed odd, and the motives unclear. It seemed almost certain that the murder was premeditated. But why kill him? His profession may hold some clues. Daniel worked as a private investigator. He found he had a talent for it and started his own company, Southern Investigations.
Daniel didn't run Southern Investigations on his own. He had a business partner by the name of Jonathan Rees, who was with him that night at the Golden Lion pub on the night of his death. The relationship between Daniel and Jonathan Rees had been going downhill prior to his death.
Daniel more and more began to feel that he wanted out, you know. He wanted out of... He didn't want to work anymore with Rees. The partnership had soured.